This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. April 9th, 1865 is widely considered the day the American Civil War ended. Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Union General Ulysses S. Grant in Appomattox, Virginia. But the bulk of the Confederate military was still armed and ready to fight. Among them, some 89,000 of General Joseph Johnston's men who were still scattered across the South. It wasn't until nearly 3 weeks after Appomattox that Johnston negotiated his own surrender with General William T. Sherman at a small farmhouse in Durham, North Carolina. It's called Bennett Place. And it was the largest surrender of the war, which is why local historians will argue that the Civil War ended in Durham. Bennett Place is marking the 150th anniversary of this surrender with new exhibits and reenactments through this Friday. And here to tell us about the end of the Civil War is John Guss. He's the site director of Bennett Place, a state historic site, and he is with us on The State of Things. Hello, John.
Hey, good afternoon.
Also with us, Ernest Dollar, the director of the Raleigh City Museum. Hello, Ernest.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. John, give us an idea of what was going on, because we know there were multiple surrenders toward the end of the war, right? So what's happening now at the time Lee surrenders at Appomattox? What else is going on around the South?
You still have other active armies all across the South that are still trying to fight to the bitter end.
Yeah, and so it did. General Johnston, of course, had 89,000 troops under his command, and that was the most significant portion of the Confederate military that was still left.
Yeah, he actually had here in this area, he had a little over 30,000 troops that were with the Army of Tennessee, and then he had active troops that were all over the Southeast, primarily in Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina, North Carolina. That's what would eventually be a result of these surrender negotiations at the Bennett Farm.
So Lee surrenders. What were Johnston's orders at that point?
The orders were to still continue the fight. President Jefferson Davis was not ready to give up the war yet.
So Sherman marched his troops into Raleigh. Johnston was on his way to Charlotte, was he?
He took his army to Greensboro, but they were stretched out as far as Charlotte.
All right. So what happens then when Sherman shows up in Raleigh?
You've got a little over 90,000 Union soldiers who were coming into Raleigh and setting up, establishing their campsite there. But it's still a temporary camp. It's they're not planning on staying there for a long period of time because they're anticipating that they're going to have to go after Joe Johnson's army all the way to Greensboro and beyond.
So there it is, and you've got 90,000 Union troops, 30,000 of Johnston troops here in North Carolina. Ernest Dollar, there are skirmishes all over, but I want to hear mostly right now about the Battle of Morrisville. Tell us about that.
Morrisville, it's one of these skirmishes in the very last dying days of the war. And, you know, as Sherman is pushing out, he's chasing Johnston's army, and they sort of clash in Morrisville. And it's at Morrisville where they sort of this note that comes in to Sherman's army that Johnston wants to talk peace. So it's kind of sort of where this sort of the war grinds to a halt and peace picks up from there.
What is Johnston doing? Is he acting on his own at this point? Again, there are still other units all over the South, and Jefferson Davis has not given up yet. So is this just a unilateral surrender?
Well, you know, the thing about Johnston is that with the Army of Northern Virginia and Lee surrendered, he had no real plan of what to do next. And he saw it as the real honorable thing to do is to somehow bring peace to the South and sort of spare his men, the people of North Carolina, any more bloodshed.
And he communicates with Sherman. Tell us about those communiques.
Well, you know, not everybody had cell phones back then, so it was kind of slow.
It was very rare.
Slow going. The first note comes into Morrisville, and these notes kind of go back between Raleigh and Hillsborough by train, by courier, and eventually they just decide to sort of meet somewhere in between their two armies. In the morning of 17th, they just start riding toward each other.
And when you say Raleigh and Hillsborough, we're talking about two train stations, essentially. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about cities at this point or major cities, right?
Right,
So they're going back and forth. And they decide, how do they decide, John Guss, on Bennett Place?
It was just a happen by chance. You have General Sherman coming out of Raleigh by train, and he arrives just really a couple of hundred yards from where we're sitting. He is escorted with his cavalry commander, Judson Kilpatrick, with a little over 200 troopers, and they start heading westward along the Hillsborough Road from the other end, coming out of Hillsboro from the Dixon Farm where General Wade Hampton had his headquarters, you have General Johnston being accompanied by Wade Hampton with about 60 cavalry troopers. So they literally just bumped into each other just beyond the Bennett farmhouse, and that was essentially the only dwelling in the area that Johnston had come across first. And so they turned their horses around and came to the Bennett farm and knocked on the door, and lo and behold, the Bennetts were gracious enough to let them come in and bar their house for a all-important meeting.
You guys can stay, but the 120,000 men you brought with you got to stay somewhere else. And that's, I think, something to point out. We're talking about the largest surrender of the war, 90,000 Union, 30,000 Confederate. This is a tiny little farm in a tinier farmhouse, right? There's not a lot of space here.
Only about 189 acres at that point in time in history. And you have James and Nancy and their daughter Eliza with one of her children. And all the male figures had died during the course of the war, so you've only got that small household. And here on April 17th, you've got a little over 260 soldiers, both blue and gray, right in their front yard. So they very well could have envisioned a possible skirmish right in their front yard or who knows what.
Was there much rough play in the time it took them to negotiate? How long did it take them to negotiate the final truce? And what was going on in that time? Ernest, can I ask you?
Well, certainly, there are still skirmishes going on as the two are meeting at Bennett Place. I think one of the most exciting things about these first Bennett negotiations is that they are negotiating in a post-Lincoln world. You know, Lincoln is assassinated, and Sherman tells Johnston this news within 5 minutes of reaching Bennett Place on April 17th. So Lincoln's ghost is in the shadows at Bennett Place and sort of shapes all of these negotiations for the weeks to come.
We should talk a little bit about these two men, too, Sherman and Johnston. Sherman, of course, not a very good reputation down here by then, but was well-respected by General Johnston.
They were both West Pointers, both old Army men. They had fought each other from the very first battles at Manassas and fought each other in North Georgia. So they had a really deep respect for each other. And you see that at Bennett Place, how these two adversaries become fast friends. And, you know, the great story you are going to hear at Bennett Place is that Johnston was an honorary pallbearer at Sherman's funeral.
And there are a lot of misconceptions, too, about Sherman. Johnston was an honorary pallbearer at Sherman's funeral and was also distraught at the news of Lincoln's assassination.
Oh, yeah, because I think Johnston knew just what this news meant for the South. That as they are approaching defeat, you know, lying at the feet of the conqueror, that to have Lincoln's assassination, that they could expect little mercy from a very angry and northern public and a very agitated army of Sherman.
What do we know about the negotiations and the terms, John, of the final agreement?
Well, in the final agreement, the terms were essentially the same as what Lee and Grant had agreed upon at Appomattox Courthouse. The terms that were discussed on and agreed upon on the 18th were rejected immediately as soon as they hit the door of the cabinet members and Andrew Johnson, who was now the new acting president of the United States. So very much different, but there was all kinds of turmoil in Washington about General Sherman had outstepped his bounds of trying to get involved in the political aspects of negotiating these surrender terms.
Well, again, this gets at the reputation of Sherman. He ends up negotiating a much more favorable truce to the South than would have been negotiated under the new administration in Washington, right?
Certainly. Again, we see Sherman leave to go meet Lincoln in March of 1865, and they kind of talk about what a post-war America would look like. And Lincoln expressed his views that he wanted to heal the nation, to bring the South back into the fold. So when Sherman meets with Johnston, he tries to fulfill Lincoln's wish. But Lincoln, his wishes died with him. And so the North is now in no mood to sort of have this brotherly reconciliation that Lincoln had wanted.
So give us some of the details of the deal and how it was received for both men, for both Johnston and for Sherman. We got some hint at how it went for Sherman.
Right. And, Sherman had always said that whenever the South decided to lay down their arms, he would be their best friend. So the Confederates actually meet again on the 18th, and they bring sort of their own surrender terms with them. How convenient. And when Sherman reads these, he's like, ah, oh, these will never do, and sets down and writes terms which are almost identical. So what gets Sherman in trouble is that he tries to end the Civil War in the Bennett House. He tries to reunite America. He tries to bring all these states back into the Union and tries to give these people their constitutional rights. But those constitutional rights include slave owning.
Also, for Johnston, things not going well because, again, there was still a strong feeling that the war should continue, that this could be a guerrilla action, take the war to the hills. So he wasn't very popular in the South.
Well, you know, this comes from Jefferson Davis, who had a lot to lose when the war ends. So Johnston, being a career military officer, wanting to save the South, save his men, knew that this guerrilla warfare was, you know, an impossible task to carry out.
And this also has great implications for the city of Durham, which was at the time, as we say, a train station at the time. But you have these 90,000 Union troops, and they got to do something, so they smoked. And they smoked something called brightleaf tobacco, which was a rare cure. And they go home, and they want some more. They start sending for it, and tell us what happens next.
Well, you know, Durham would not be Durham without this. Fuels the explosion of all of the tobacco production in Durham, where the Dukes grow amazingly rich off of this explosion, and it just propels Durham into the 21st century. It sort of gets us here today. And one of the most unique monuments you're going to see dealing with the Civil War is at Bennett Place. There's the Unity Monument that was erected in 1923. And those folks who started to decide to erect this monument saw it as a great way, as a genesis for Durham. They wanted to mark Durham's birth at Bennett Place.
Well, it may be true that the largest surrender of the Civil War took place in Durham, but as we say, it was tobacco that put Durham on the map. Washington Duke was responsible for that. He was serving in the Confederate Navy when the war ended. He would later become the tobacco magnate who would be the founder of American Tobacco and established a successful business in Durham and the institution that would eventually become Duke University. But he had to walk from his post in New Bern, 160 miles back home to Durham. And to mark the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, Philip Brown's going to take that same walk. He's a graduate student at UNC Greensboro and joins me now on the State of Things. Welcome, Philip.
How are we doing?
We're doing great. Tell us about this walk you're going to take.
Well, we'll be walking from New Bern to Durham, and the idea is not to prolong the commemoration of the Civil War, the 150th cycle that's been going on since 2010, but to try to bring back the memory of the fact that the men of the Civil War, both Union and Confederate, had to struggle in some ways to get home. And so we're going to be recreating the walk that many Confederate soldiers had to take throughout the late spring of 65.
Can you give us some of the route? Where are you going to be walking?
Well, we'll be moving from New Bern to Kinston, headed towards Smith Field, and then we'll enter the Raleigh-Durham area, Clayton, Raleigh, and then eventually Durham, of course. There's a number of towns we'll be passing through. Basically, I'll be walking from town to town, so each night I'll be in a different location.
It is interesting. He was in the Navy at the time, and as you say, the war ends, and you just go home, right? You don't even get a train ticket.
Correct. He was in the Navy. He was most likely transferred to the service of the artillery on the land right at the end of the war. He was actually drawn up to the Richmond defenses right at the end and was captured likely at the Battle of Sailor's Creek shortly after Robert E. Lee vacated the city of Richmond.
So he left. He was a prisoner of war at the time.
He was, correct, yes.
How did he get from Richmond to New Bern?
That is one of the great mysteries of the Duke family. We don't know if he was exchanged off a federal boat into New Bern or if he caught a ride out to sea, thinking that was the best way to get home was actually go down to New Bern and walk in. You have to understand the rail lines had been likely destroyed all around Richmond.
One of the interesting things about the Duke family, and Washington Duke in particular, is that we are told that they actually opposed North Carolina's entry into the war. They opposed slavery. They had a relatively small farm. Is that true? And if so, why did he become a part of the Confederate Navy?
Correct. He was in his 40s when the war began. It was always said that he was opposed to slavery and opposed to secession. He was conscripted or drafted in his Confederate service in his mid-40s. And was in the Navy for the remainder of his service. And then after the war, he actually became a Republican, which was, of course, Abraham Lincoln's party.
Do you? I have to ask you this question. You are among the members of that great body of reenactors. Why do you do it?
A lot of people ask me that question, and I look at it in terms of what I call visual history, which isn't really a real field, academically speaking. But I just find value in bringing about the visual of what we think Civil War soldiers look like, and doing our best to represent that in visual terms. And I also get, I have to admit, some experiential learning out of it in wearing the uniforms and living as best I can as a Civil War soldier. Of course, we only get a very, very small snapshot of life, and unfortunately so.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Philip Brown is a historian and a reenactor. He's going to be walking the path of Washington Duke from New Bern to Duke Homestead, and that will start May 11th. You're kind of going at a warm time of year. You got to wear the whole wool outfit the whole time?
Correct. It's stitch for stitch, the original uniform that he likely wore.
All right. Good luck. Thank you, Philip Brown. Ernest Dollar has also been with us. He is the director of the Raleigh City Museum. And John Gus is site director at Bennett Place State Historic Site in Durham. Bennett Place hosting the 150th anniversary events through this Friday. Ernest and John, thank both of you for being on the program as well.
Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
You can find out more about the end of the Civil War and the festivities going on all this week and throughout the state at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jess Clark is our intern. WUNC's news director is Brent Wolf. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.